This is Uncle Don bringing you the 337th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. We're told that Canada is fighting in Afghanistan for a changing slate of reasons, more likely rationalizations. In the beginning, we participated in Bush's invasion and occupation, as the attack on the World Trade Center was supposedly conceived by Afghans. We're gonna get Osama bin Laden. By the time we learned the Taliban were not in bed with Al-Qaeda, we'd overthrown the government of Afghanistan, and the country had fallen apart. Since we were there, we thought we might as well forge a democracy from a backward medieval collection of fiefdoms. Democracy failed to sprout in the barren soil of Afghanistan. Oh well, we'll instead persuade our puppet Hamid Karzai to stamp out corruption. With a system so infused and fueled by kickbacks, bribes, and nepotism, this rollback of corruption appears impossible, especially under the fraudulently elected Karzai. With Osama bin Laden still on the loose, democracy in tatters and corruption rampant, we are then bent upon liberating Afghan women. Fat chance. Under the Afghan version of Islam, women are property, no more likely to be granted human rights than are their domestic animals. Well, we can build schools to educate girls in the enlightened ways of the West. As fast as we build them, the Taliban blow them up, except for those brave or foolish girls attending the show schools existing under heavy guard. Afghan females remain barefoot, ignorant, and appear in public only in company of a male escort when adorned in burlap bags. Those daring to pursue an education can be rewarded with splashes of acid in the face. We aren't just pursuing will-o'-the-wisp causes in Afghanistan, but our government works at cross-purposes with our professed goals. In randomly arresting Afghans and turning them over to torturers, we negated the pursuit of gaining acceptance by average citizens. As Richard Colton, heroic whistleblower, said, "Instead of winning hearts and minds, we caused Kandaharis to fear the foreigners. Canada's detention practices alienated us from the population and strengthened the insurgency." Let me wander outside the box here. Might it be that all the rationalizations we've been given for this war are moot? Suppose, just suppose, that the intent of our leaders is to give Canada's government an excuse to bolster our military and, consequently, feed the arms industry. There's nothing like a good war, that is, one overseas against a harmless adversary, to rally public support behind the current Canadian regime. We've been told you can't change horses in midstream, so Canada needs the like of Stephen Harper's horses to save the nation. I think that, by process of elimination, we're left with the necessary conclusion that this war against Afghanistan is a prefabrication built on a prevarication. Want to hear a good Canadian joke? Try this. Open and accountable government. Harper and his minions were elected on a platform that they would open government information to public scrutiny. They would be accountable to the Canadian public. Manure. Members of the Conservative caucus aren't allowed to tell reporters the time of day without clearing it first with the PMO. When Harper's regime is accused of violating rules or laws, it's a standard formula to deny, delay, and discredit their critics. Canada's journalists, those who interpret the world to the public, are routinely denied access to documents or public officials. The Prime Minister gave a speech the other day lauding reporters. Then he slipped out, avoiding questions. Some openness. Stephen Harper lives in terror of unfavorable photographs and film clips. He travels with his own photographers, who make sure that only flattering pictures are distributed. He's scared spitless of demonstrations. How else could one explain the choice of Iqaluit in February as a venue for the G7 meeting of finance ministers? Do you suppose that this place was chosen by popular demand of these officials? Do they long for eternal night in bone-chilling cold in this blizzard capital of Canada? Perhaps it was the easy access to Iqaluit that influenced Harper's choice. Of course, the expense of reaching this remote location is of no concern to ministers who travel on the government tab, but it will certainly trim the ambitions of independent reporters and groups seeking to protest policies. Watch for pretty photos of these officials in their parkas, perhaps munching seal meat. News, of course, will only be forthcoming from approved and tame reporters. Others might find that flights to Iqaluit have been entirely booked and no accommodation is available up there. So much for open and accountable. As I walk through Prince George's streets, ride its buses, and wander the halls of U.S. these days to damage your hearing without effort. As for me, I achieved my current degree of deafness the hard way. I worked for it. I chose to fire guns in the Army before ear protection was required. I worked an assembly line for Ford, squeezing into tight spaces with an air gun next to my head. I spent more than a year in a steel mill in the cacophony of sound from sirens, horns, rumbling machinery, and crashing scrap metal. As I watch those blasting their heads with high-volume music, I wonder if it isn't a good time to invest in hearing aid manufacturers. The greatest affront to my ears came while I worked in the mines. I was dumb enough to do this twice. Nothing compares with the rattle of a pair of jack-leg drills echoing in a granite drift. Now that I have been above ground for a few decades, I hardly think of my mining experiences more than a couple times a day. Mining of the old sort, between the days of the pick and shovel and today's mechanical monsters, had to be the most demanding work I could imagine, and I had it under some of the best conditions. Both mines were hard rock as opposed to soft ground coal mines. We worried about silicosis, but our mine didn't harbor pockets of explosive methane. Our conditions were nothing like the primitive coal mines of China, which claimed the lives of 3,000 workers every year. Our 1,000-foot level, the temperature was a steady 55 degrees Fahrenheit, winter and summer. We were constantly wet from groundwater seeping through seams. Becoming a competent miner required as much time as earning a university degree. The old-time miners I worked with labored with a dogged, competent diligence. In Sudbury, the best of the best were the Newfoundlanders. One day I was working with another novice, and as we always worked in pairs, drilling on a rock face, or rather, trying to drill. This required wrestling 100 pounds of jack-leg drill with attached water and air hoses while trying to get a 2-foot bit started into an irregular rock face. Both of us found our bits wandering in the hydraulic leg unmanageable. Along came our newfie foreman. Seeing my partner's plight, he took over the machine and began to drill like it was nothing. When he saw that I was likewise having trouble, he reached over, collared my hole, all the while managing the partner's drill. So for a few minutes, he ran both drills effortlessly. This is one of those impossible feats akin to flying a loop in a helicopter. A competent miner and his partner were expected to perform the following within the 8-hour minimum maximum underground allowed by the Ontario Mining Act. There was no overtime under 1,000 feet of rock. Once the pair was dropped to the working level in the cage, or open elevator, they walked to their working face. As they approached the newly blasted area, they used long scaling bars to test the roof for loose rock. Failure to pry insecure pieces free could mean they would fall later with possible nasty consequences. In the time since the previous shift, a 6-foot extension of the drift was blasted loose and the broken muck hauled off with a large scoop tram, a modified front-end loader. The pair of arriving miners had to dig loose rock from the shattered face, making sure there were no traces of blasting powder hiding in unbroken holes. Then they marked with spray paint the spots to be drilled. These formed concentric circles with a cluster in the center. They set up their machines with attached hoses and began drilling parallel 6-foot holes in the granite. When they drilled the lower holes, they had to haul in planks, building a staging from which they could reach the higher one. When all the holes were drilled, they were fitted with fuses and blasting caps. A machine blew nitrocarbonitrate, the combination of nitrogen fertilizer and diesel fuel favored by car bombers, into the holes, and an igniter cord connected to the fuses in a pattern that made the central cluster of holes shatter first, with consecutive blasting of the outer holes following. Finally, the lifters, or bottom holes, ignited, ideally lifting the entire mass of shattered ore out and onto the floor for the scoop tram to clean up before the next shift arrived. Before the igniter cord was lit, all machinery and scaffolding was removed to a safe area where they would not be buried in debris. With all cleared, the cord was lit and the pair buggered off to a safe distance around a couple of corners. Two pairs of miners worked opposite shifts, relying on each other to get a 6-foot round drilled and blasted so the area would be ready for the next shift. Monthly bonuses were paid based on the distance drilled and had extended so one incomplete blast could cost both pairs money. Two competent pairs working back-to-back could triple their wages with bonuses. This was serious money. regular partners bonded in a way that made wives jealous. 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, these men depended on each other's competence for their lives. In my short time at INCO, I had a regular partner who became very close. We even shared an apartment. We were not good miners. We never achieved a production that would cover our wages. Other miners looked askance when we walked from the cage to the work site. They thought it odd that we would sing the song of the seven dwarfs as we skipped awkwardly down the drift. Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go was considered out of place. Well, we had our moments of levity along with the arduous labor. One day we took a break far down our drift from other miners. We sat with our hard hat lamps turned off, listening to the rocks sing, and my partner John said, "You know, when you turn off your lamp down here, you can see F all." And he was right. Nothing screened sunlight like 1,000 feet of granite. And the rock did sing. When we were sitting quietly, far from other drillers, we could hear the high-pitched scream of granite shifting along fractures. We knew it was moving. That's why we had to use scaling bars on the roof between shifts. Rock that was solid one last shift was often loose 16 hours later. One time a few of us were sitting near a branch of two drifts. At the fork was a broad stretch of unsupported roof, from which a massive piece, the size of a Volkswagen Bug, broke loose without warning, landing in the middle of the floor not far from us. We looked and carried on our conversation where we had left off. There was nothing to say. It could have happened any time, anywhere down there, but we didn't want to talk about that. We left that speculation to wives and sweethearts on the surface. Work in underground grows on a man. The camaraderie that rapidly develops is probably akin to that of soldiers in combat. It doesn't take long before a miner looks at those working above ground as not having real jobs. Real work is underground. With my brief experiences, I understand somewhat the plight of those Nova Scotia miners, suddenly unemployed when their mines closed. With years underground in that environment, what were they to do? Become bank tellers and shoe salesmen? The coal dust was in their blood, and with the work gone, they died inside. I have some inside information for you speculators out there. This encapsulated wisdom comes from a market advisor's newsletter. Here it is, quote, "While the nascent bull trend remains intact, there's increasing evidence that we're bumping up against cyclic tops in near-term performance. When trend reversals occur, it's necessary to rebalance portfolio asset allocation, either by category, sector, or security type," close quote. There it is from the professionals. Now go out there and make a bundle. It was in 1961, as President Eisenhower was handing power over to President-elect Kennedy, that he made his farewell address to the American people. The heart of this speech was the following: "This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist." Just 15 years earlier, the world emerged from the Second World War with the United States in the catbird seat. Having escaped domestic destruction from that war, it had fully half of the world's industry, a huge military machine, and an unrivaled capacity for production of war materiel. Citizens hoped for a massive peace dividend with that industrial muscle applied to supplying civilian needs which had remained unfulfilled during the war. To some extent, this happened with massive production of refrigerators, automobiles, and other stuff. But it was not enough to keep the factories running and get the returning veterans working. The Marshall Plan for reconstruction of Western Europe was a godsend for the American economy, with massive amounts of food, clothing, building materials, and everything else required to restore devastated lands. This didn't satisfy heavy industry geared up for war production. Shipyards were not easily adapted to light industry. Factories which had become so efficient in making bombers and fighters needed orders. Fortunately for industrialists, the Cold War followed the Hot War. Americans were told of dire threats posed by massive Soviet forces poised to conquer all of Europe. Countering the danger of a Russian attack required more of those weapons and material which these folks produced so efficiently, thus saving them from bankruptcy. It was only later that the public discovered how badly Russians were prepared for another war, but the perceived threat had served its purpose. Ever since those dark days of World War II, there's always been one threat or another legitimizing the maintenance of that standing army that generals, from Washington to Eisenhower, warned their people about. The U.S. military, now costing a full half as much as the entire world spends on armed forces, is unchallenged. So why does the country continue to squander billions or trillions on a military far beyond anything it could conceivably need? This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. I have a hypothesis. I suggest that the United States has suffered a silent, insidious military coup, with the Pentagon now dictating policy to the rest of government. The evidence is circumstantial, but the accumulation is persuasive. Toward the end of the Second World War, Western allies had an opportunity to reach out to the Soviet Union from a position of overwhelming strength. All of the world's peoples were exhausted by years of war and clamoring for peace. With universal horror over the devastation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there were serious proposals to internationalize technology of the atomic bomb and keep the genie in the bottle. Instead, President Truman, with support of the Pentagon, embarked on a massive program leading to an ever more awesome hydrogen bomb. They chose to bleed a prostrate Soviet Union as it strove to match the American program. When Russia unveiled its own nuclear weapons, the ensuing panic in the States was harnessed to redouble efforts to expand its military, especially the Air Force and missile systems, much to the profit of the military-industrial complex. The Korean War was arguably provoked by South Korea, an entity left in the Western camp by the splitting of the peninsula as part of World War II settlement. Engagement in that war gave a much-needed boost to American militarism and armaments manufacturers. It was in 1951, during that war, that General MacArthur challenged the authority of President Truman and was removed from command. This is the last evidence seen of a successful executive challenge to independence of America's military establishment. Then came Vietnam and the harebrained domino theory. All of Asia would have fallen to communism if the U.S. failed to conquer a native force of pajama-clad soldiers in sandals. That losing endeavor cost America 50,000 lives and Vietnam millions, but it served the purpose of keeping money flowing to the military machine. Surviving officers received many promotions, the legacy of which remains in vast numbers of general officers clogging the corridors of the Pentagon. The Berlin Wall was torn down, and the U.S. military again faced the challenge of a citizenry demanding a peace dividend, where spending could be channeled toward social welfare and refurbishing a deteriorating infrastructure. Fortunately for the military, a band of Islamic fanatics pulled off the World Trade Center caper, to which George Wanker Bush responded by declaring war on Afghanistan instead of treating the sabotage as a police matter. There they are, 8 years into the Afghan war, as well as their holding action in Iraq. Their government says it cost U.S. $1 million a year to support a soldier on the ground in Afghanistan. But this is not money that disappears. It goes to buy food and clothing, ammunition and guns, vehicles and fuel, all supplied by corporations making huge profits at the public trough. Then there are the mercenaries increasingly replacing real soldiers whose contracts are shrouded in secrecy. Military contractors cleverly spread their operations into nearly every congressional district in the land, creating captive constituencies relying on local spending and jobs. They, their families, and communities have a vested interest in maintaining a huge military establishment in spite of the inherent waste of talent, resources, and labor. Another project absorbing inordinate resources and promising to demand more is the much-hyped attempt to build an American base on the moon. Forgive me for my suspicion that such a base would have nothing to do with going on a reckless, useless mission to Mars. I believe this to be another facet of the Pentagon's expressed ambition to achieve what they call full-spectrum dominance. Their goal at sea, largely completed, brought control of the world's oceans with multiple fleets of ships, each composed of aircraft carriers, missiles, and support vessels. The world's skies are already dominated by the U.S. Air Force, whose huge numbers of bombers, fighter aircraft, drones, and their bases sit stationed strategically around the globe. The U.S. sports a huge standing Army and Marine Corps, ready to be sent anywhere on short notice by troop-carrying aircraft and their refueling tankers. American ambition to build those forces further is somewhat hampered by a lack of conscription, but that may be restored by President Obama. Meanwhile, military body snatchers prowl the ghettos, school corridors, and backwaters of America, persuading hopeless youth of the great advantages of a military hitch. The final building block of that full-spectrum dominance is control of space. With satellites already in orbit, the one remaining high ground, so to speak, is our moon. A missile base on the moon could rain death anywhere on the planet, from which there would be no defense. That's promising to be achieved under cover of creating a jumping-off place for Mars exploration. While the American military establishment pursues its goal of full-spectrum dominance, the civilian economy and the world of reality dictates otherwise. First of all, the United States faces no realistic challenges to its security other than those it has created itself. The much-vaunted terrorist threat, to the extent that it exists at all, is a child of its own policies, particularly in unstinting support for Israel's predations. No world military power exists to threaten the United States. The professed fear of rogue states such as Iran and North Korea is almost laughable. It's obvious to all that an attack by such a state would result in its rapid conversion to a radioactive wasteland. Looking at the whole picture, with the American economy on life support, largely through the financing of its covert ally China, there seems to be no explanation of its funneling a full half of the federal government discretionary spending into a monstrous bloated military machine, except that this establishment is dictating policy to a shell of puppets maintaining the fiction of a democratic government. Some indigenous inhabitants of Haida Gwaii strenuously object to the building of a wind farm on Rose Spit, although the community has already invested $250 million in the project. Their complaint rests on the native's creation story, maintaining that the first human beings clambered out of a clamshell on the beach at Rose Spit. This belief is blasphemous to those of us who know that man was actually created 6,000 years ago, culminating the sky god's six-day do-it-yourself job of creating the universe from whole cloth. God created man in his divine image, appendix and all, then popped out a rib, which became a woman. These original folks were then given a lease on the entire planet holus bolus. Wherever do the Haida get such strange ideas in the face of proven facts? I was doing our laundry the other day, letting my mind run in neutral as it is wont to do during undemanding chores. As I loaded clothes from the washer to the dryer, I wonder whatever happened to the one-time project to combine washing and drying in a single machine. Supposedly the project was abandoned as impractical for technical reasons. Wouldn't you think with the fancy stuff we have now that such problems could be overcome? Then it dawned on me. There's a very sound reason for not combining these functions. Manufacturers would then have a market for only half the number of products. We should be grateful that we haven't separate machines for washing and rinsing, which I suppose we would if some inventor hadn't ruined that potential by coming up with a single washing machine. When I last crossed our southern border by train, I was put off by the goon squad of American Customs and Immigration officers strutting through our car with their big guns and bigger attitudes. I hadn't seen the like since the West German soldiers frisked our train coming in from the east during the Cold War. For years I've resisted any latent desire to visit the States, especially in light of their policy of extraordinary rendition of foreigners they don't like. Now I have another good reason not to cross that border, the necessity of return. It wasn't long ago I could count on a cursory inspection of documents and baggage, then a welcome home from Canadian border guards. It looks like there's a new generation of such folks working, and their attitude has been adopted from their counterparts on the other side. It was truly shameful the way they abused Amy Goodman, host of the daily Democracy Radio show from New York, one which precedes my weekly rants. Her programs provide a much-needed window into the real world of events not available elsewhere in the media. She was held at the border for 75 minutes on her way to a meeting in Vancouver where she was to speak. Our mini-Gestapo ransacked her papers and computer while she was questioned about the topics she was to cover. They repeatedly demanded to know what she would be saying about the Olympics, although she had no intention of mentioning the coming event. Amy was flagged as a dissident by someone or agency on either side of the border. Such an outspoken radio journalist must be perceived as a security threat to Harper's little fiefdom, and the Olympics is a no-no for any criticism by a nasty foreigner. I move to question whether our government, such as it is, sponsoring this Olympic fiasco, or whether the International Olympic Committee is Canada's temporary de facto government. Is it any concern of our customs and immigration officers whether visitors, especially journalists, are supporters of this wasteful exercise in athletics? Who's in charge here? I had a long talk the other day with an old friend now living in Ontario who used to teach at UNBC. His father's an old bugger like me. He's retired with a nice pension and healthy savings. He lives in England and is thinking of immigrating to Canada. He visited here in the 60s and the country impressed him. I agreed with my friend that this was not a good idea. Canada's not the same country it was in the 60s, nor in the 70s when I immigrated. The differences are more than generational. The 60s were not just the Beatles and flower power, free love and dope. There was an intangible feeling that things were improving, that we were all part of something greater. Expo 67 united the country with a spirit of togetherness, a spirit in stark contrast to the sticky hype we feel today with the Olympics and the fabricated, hollow excitement of the tacky torch procession weaving back and forth across the land. We had a feeling of freedom that is hard to describe. Canada was welcoming war resistors from Nixon's horror show of a war against Indochina. Trudeau told young people to hit the road and see their country, a call answered en masse. At that time, Prince George had a youth hostel that saw kids visit from all over the country. The new Medicare system was well-funded and efficient. Unemployment insurance was generous, covering most who lost jobs. Downtown Prince George was the vibrant center of business, mostly locally owned. Social services thrived. The old United Way building, now replaced with a defunct casino, housed several agencies, including the new crisis center in which I was active for years. Now look at our country in the age of globalization. The Reagan-Thatcher revolution has changed most nations as it has Canada. The spirit has died. The feeling of togetherness manifests itself in smaller groups, but in the streets it's more like the American every man for himself. Those of us with the means have larger houses, big vehicles, and huge flat-screen television. Those without means fill the downtown streets and feed at St. Vincent de Paul. We tend to cocoon at home in our nests, fragmented and barely knowing our neighbors. We've allowed a bunch of power-hungry politicians to take over governments with promises of lower taxes, but failing to tell us we will pay with collapsing infrastructure, impoverished services, homelessness, and child poverty. We shut the mental institutions and built jails. We sent liars and schemers to Ottawa and Victoria, then wonder why they fed their nest of the wealthy while allowing Mallwart and its ilk to undermine wage rates and democratic unions. Over the years, the top 10% of wealthy have seen their share of national income increase several fold, while wages, even the minimum wage, stagnated in the face of inflation. 20 years ago, Parliament resolved to eliminate child poverty in a decade. Yet today, all too many children haven't a chance to reach university, much less go to school with a full belly. No, this is not a nation to which my friend's father should aspire. He'd be leaping from one sinking ship into another. This concludes another jolly edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. As a blatant filler to complete my half hour, I leave you with the following quotation from the Greek historian Herodotus. Quote, "Very few things happen at the right time, and the rest do not happen at all. The conscientious historian will correct these defects."